Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 7 of Cinemental.
Now, this I can do.
I can't compete with you physically, and you're no match for my brains.
I don't give a crap if you covered yourself in peanut butter and had a 15-hooker gangbang.
Right. As always, I'm joined by Hassan Godwin and Latham Conger III. Once again, this week, we're joined by a guest, and we will be discussing one of her favorite films. Our guest has been working with sexuality for over a decade. She has written for The New York Times, Playboy, The Guardian, and many others. She's half of Slate.com's sex advice column, How to Do It, and her book, Philosophy, Pussycats, and Porn, which I own a copy of, is available through Not a Cult Media. You can follow her adult work at zerospaces.com. And we welcome into the show today, Stoya. Hi, Stoya.
Hi. I have a cat in my lap. His
the
name's
best
Pixel.
Thing in the world.
Yes.
Welcome.
That is one of the great things about owning cats is just having them on you. Luckily, one of our two cats is likes to do that. The other one is a little bit more standoffish, the brother and sister, but completely different personalities. It's kind of fun to watch the two of them together. So we don't have much news that gives us fits today.
Move!
What?
Not you here.
Technical problem.
No, I ran across one stupid thing this morning, but I wasn't going to bring it up. But this is so weird. Literally, I just opened MovieWeb and posted like this must have been late last night. So apparently, Jason Reitman is directing an at-home remake, I guess on Zoom, but he's doing The Princess Bride.
Oh, wow.
With Sophie Turner, Hugh Jackman, Elijah Wood, and more.
What, a read?
I guess. It must be like a live table read kind of thing.
Yeah.
Holy cow.
That's weird timing.
Joe Jonas, Common, Tiffany Haddish, Neil Patrick Harris, Andy Serkis, Keegan-Michael Key, Jack Black, Diego Luna, Taika Waititi, John Hamm. Jesus Christ.
So it's a small cast.
Yeah. Josh Gad, Patton Oswalt, with original director Rob Reiner and Fred Savage, who were reprising his role as the grandson.
Couldn't get any A-listers, I guess.
Yeah, I guess they couldn't get anybody, any big names involved.
Yeah.
Wow. That's cool.
I'd
rather see that than an actual remake.
Yeah, but that would.
That's a movie you don't remake. So
right, one hopes.
Pointless.
Yeah.
One hopes. All right, so.
Well, it was announced yesterday. I'm just trying to get my facts straight here. But I wanted to check one thing. In regards to this cancel culture stuff going on, there seems to be a new news article about it every day, and yesterday, they announced that the guy who voices one of the characters on Family Guy, his name's Mike Henry, he's a voice actor. He is stepping down from the role of voicing Cleveland on Family Guy, which he has been doing for over 20 years. And it's because he's white and he feels a black actor should take the voice role over. So... I mean, I have many opinions on cancel culture, but this one, I guess, bothers me the most merely because he's been in the role for so long, and it just seems like a reactionary kick to me, either to affect his wallet or make sure his wallet isn't affected. And when you've established a role for that long, and people never complained about it, and you're almost preemptively just trying to avoid a problem down the line that might not ever come. I think this is taking what's going on in society with media and like I said, cancel culture it's going too far right now. And it just bothered me that people are making these decisions based on the zeitgeist of what, everything that that is happening out there. So I don't know. What do you guys think?
I feel like you're projecting emotion that may not be there. You're framing it as them doing this preemptively out of fear of social judgment, but it really could be that actor saying it should have been a black person the whole time. This was never right. And the only way to make it right is to do that now.
Right. But I think his question is more about the timing. Why now? Is it just because now we're in this sort of time when all of that is, you know, I mean, just 2 days ago, to your point, Leigh, Kristen Bell and Jenny Slate both stepped down from their roles, voice acting roles that they'd been doing for the last 2 or 3 years on animated shows, because they felt that the character should have been voiced by people of matching race.
That's how I feel. And actually, there were some people after this was announced that this is not going to help black people. It's going to hurt them because you're going to limit their roles. You're going to limit them having voice roles for only black animated characters. There are plenty of white.
No.
It's a really hard, I'm going to try to talk about this delicately. I have people in my life I'm very close to who are straight white men. And it's really hard for them to understand that everyone else's life is harder. And there's a thing that we say, which is punch up, not down. And it is different given the societal context. It is different to have a woman voicing a young man than it is having a white man and voicing a black man. It is different for that opportunity of employment to go to a white woman. Also, like, there's a production problem here. How many grown males have a voice that sounds like a young boy? And this is like a multi-decade show. So there's like a production reason to have a woman do it, at least from what I assume. And there's no production reason to have a white guy voice in Cleveland.
Well, my point I was going to make too is there are plenty of black voice actors that voice white roles. So now you're limiting yourself to hypocrisy if you do this, if you make this statement. And people are going to point that out, and they're logically correct. So it's, again, the timing is bad. And what are you going to do with all the product of Family Guy for the past 20 years? Are we going to redub everything so that people don't hear that guy as the voice of Cleveland from episode one? Are we going to, you know, have search parties out there trying to remove DVD sets from people? I mean,
Latham, the logic. How far is this going to go is just sloppy rhetoric.
No, I don't agree with that. I'm a person of logic, and if you can logically sustain something as to not making any sense and can bring up points to it, then that's the rabbit hole I'll always go down there.
Yeah, the other problem, to touch on the Dixie Chicks thing, I get them removing Dixie. I understand their removal of its connotation and whatnot, which, again,
you have to remove it from everything, though. You can't just remove it.
If they choose to remove it from their own, the name of their band, that's up to them. That's fine. But I thought that their choice to call themselves the Chicks was odd, because wouldn't that just be a separate can of worms they're stepping into? Yes, ma'am.
Yes.
As a woman.
Yes.
just because, like, that's kind of what this is turning into.
Well, this is what I thought. I'm like, you're calling yourself the Chicks now. Isn't somebody just going to turn around and say, well, isn't Chicks like a derogatory term for a woman?
So as a woman, it's our right to use that kind of language about ourselves. And to speak to the timing point, there's a positive interpretation. I feel like that's like the discussion of timing that's happened right now has been from a not a neutral point, but like kind of a negative, somewhat judgmental. And there's a positive interpretation, which is that all of this discussion occurring in public view of social justice, the need for social justice, of the horrible history of so many things that we take casually. Like eeny, meeny, miny, moe, turns out deeply problematic. Yes. I had no idea. Yeah.
Yeah, you don't really know how many of those things in our society are prevalent. And it's hard to explain that to people because they don't want to really hear it. They just say, look, I grew up with it. There's nothing wrong with it. I don't mean anything by it. And a lot of people think that the intent behind it is enough to justify it. But not everybody knows your intent, you know?
Right.
So the things that are problematic at least need to be addressed. And they usually are not addressed. And that's kind of what the situation now, it's reactionary. You want to address these things before they become reactionary, such as, say, the logo for the Indians, which they've peaceably been trying to address for quite a while.
Or the Redskins.
Yes. And well, that's what I meant. I don't know baseball. But
Redskins are football, but that's fine.
It doesn't matter.
Right. Yes.
It doesn't matter. Stop stepping on my soapbox here. And every time it's brought up, everyone's like, well, it's tradition. What about the Fighting Irish? You know, like, you know, just, you know, and it's not the same. It's not self-applied, you know? When you self-apply, perhaps, derogatory language, it's between you and your own demographic. It's your choice. When it is applied for you and used commercially so that people who are not you profit from it and benefit from it or can use it derogatorily or, you know, wearing it on T-shirts or whatever, then it's kind of it's an affront. And it's not like no one was offended by that from the beginning. It's that the people who are offended didn't politically matter. So we're not going to address it. And when the politics change, people start coming for the things that, you know, they feel are an affront to them.
Also,
and it was ignored.
And I've turned down at least one press opportunity because it was all white chicks. And when I did so, I was like, hey, you know, I'm really hoping that you choose to replace, to use that slot for someone of color, someone who's curvy. I mean, super thick would be great, but like, I'm not even asking for that. Like, just like some amount of diversity. And they freaking laughed at me. Like, I heard later the whole office was like, you wouldn't believe what Stoya did, because it wasn't a time that conversation was possible. And now everyone's stuck at home. They've got all the free time in the world. Like, middle-class white people have all the free time in the world to educate ourselves. And now it's possible to make these changes. So, you know, to take it back to the original news item, this man who spent 20 years building the character of Cleveland, do you think he wanted to risk giving it up when it might just go to a guy? Like, it might feel nice to storm out and make these big productions when it just makes us feel good about like proving that we're not racist. But the real work is picking an appropriate time when it's useful, when it actually makes a statement that people are ready to hear. That's my big rant.
You know, let's talk about something fun.
Yeah.
Let's go fun. It's Saturday morning. Let's go fun instead.
A couple of years ago, maybe last year, actually, one of my friends got married and I was in the wedding party, and they asked me to make a speech. I was like, of course I'll make a speech. And then I wrote some notes in my phone, and you know, one person made their speech and another person made their speech. There was a drag king hosting. They were delightful. And then it was my turn and I stand up and I say, marriage. And then, you know, I talked about how the Princess Bride is a fairy tale and like that's not a realistic thing until you look at these two, and like being close to their relationship actually does feel like a tale. Let's all toast, whatever. But in case it wasn't obvious, this episode's movie is
That's correct. Stoya's choice of film is The Princess Bride.
I brought you a special present.
What is it? A book?
This is a special book. It was the book my father used to read to me when I was sick, and I used to read it to your father. And today, I'm going to read it to you.
I'll try and stay awake.
You never say anything about killing anyone.
I just happened to look behind us and something is there.
He's obviously seen us with the princess and let's therefore die. Pick up one of those rocks. Get behind the boulder. The minute his head is in view, hit it with the rock!
I was not a sportsman, lad.
What did you read me this thing for?
Well, who says life is fair? Where is that written?
Directed by Rob Reiner, running 98 minutes. Based on William Goldman's classic fairy tale of a farm boy who leaves his true love behind to make his worldly fortune, and the pirate who returns to rescue his true love from the clutches of an evil prince. Latham, how long had it been since you've seen this movie?
Well, I didn't see it when it came out in 87. I saw it probably for the first time early 90s. I just missed it. Just didn't have any interest. I saw it then maybe once or twice before watching it yesterday.
Okay. Hassan?
I think I saw it on HBO. I never got to the theater to see it, but I saw it in the 80s. You know, like okay. I saw it maybe a year later or whatever when it came out on what was then streaming media.
Had you seen it since?
Maybe 1,000 times since then.
Okay. Yeah. That,
and I'm not exaggerating that number.
No.
Did you and watch it for your homework, Hassan?
Did not need to, but I did.
Yeah.
Oh, any excuse to watch it again.
I am very much the same way about this film. It's funny. I wrote down in my notes that this is not my favorite film, but I watch no other film with any regularity that elicits such pure joy consistently throughout this film as this movie does for me. So Toya, why this film for you? Why is this your favorite movie?
It's just so comforting. Like, I like that it's fantastical, but like, there's this little fine line where the scary parts are scary for the characters, but not as viewer. Like, you're like, I'm watching something that is very frightening for these people, but I'm fine, which is a big part of, like, comfort for me. And favorite has this connotation of like thing I return to when I want to feel good.
Right.
Yeah. So that's how I interpreted the assignment.
Yeah. Probably over the last 10 years, I've caught this film, bits and pieces of it, just because it's on regular commercial TV, multiple channels on a fairly regular basis. I hadn't put it on to actually sit and watch it start to finish for actually longer than I probably should admit, but it never gets old. I never get tired of seeing it. If I run across it on the channel guide, I'll put it on while I'm checking the rest of the guide to see what else is on, just because I can listen to it and you know, I know every line in this film. You know, I have another note here that says possibly the single most quotable film ever.
Inconceivable.
And that's one of the top five or six, but just going through this movie last night, as I'm watching it, I'm realizing that I know every line they're going to say before they say it. And there's very few films. I mean, there's always movies, especially with guys like us who watch films all the time. We have films that we know a lot of lines from. Pick a movie and we're going to be able to pull a quote from it that off the top of our heads. But from this movie, it seems like there is not a single scene or almost any shot with dialogue in this film that does not have a quotable line in that sequence, which is amazing, content wise, and from a writing standpoint, it's amazing. Every joke lands. You know, I still think all the jokes work. I was laughing even harder last night at some of the stuff, just because, you know, I think that over time you start to appreciate things differently, and you, because of things you go through in your life, whatever, and that, you know, certain jokes that you may have thought were funny at one time become even funnier because now you know something else about, maybe even it's about that actor. I have a huge thing about Andre the Giant. There's a great documentary on him, if you haven't seen it, just called Andre, that is in it. You know, even if you know his life and know how things end with him, it still just completely wrecked me watching it, because it's still just heartbreaking. There's people who work in entertainment who you hear about and who you read about, and you just think, man, I would really like to hang out with that guy, or I'd really like to get to know that guy as a person. And I think Andre the Giant definitely would have been one of those people. So from there, does anybody have anything they want to jump into about it? Lay?
I mean, yeah, I still like it a lot in regards to like dialogue. Yeah, there's nothing wasted as far as anything in the film. It's a very trim movie. The screenplay is, it's hard to write such a memorable film that's only that long, especially in today's movie culture. But this one stands up for that specific reason, that it's a short film, but you remember it. You remember every scene in it, and it resonates with you, especially for those of us who grew up in the 80s. I don't remember why I didn't see it when it first came out, or why I wasn't interested in seeing it, because it was right in my wheelhouse.
Sure.
And if I remember, did it come out in the summer or spring, maybe? I'm trying to remember, of 87, if anyone has the release date.
That's a great question.
I feel like it was surrounded by other films that were a lot harder edge, like maybe Predator and other blockbusters that came out in 87, Lethal Weapon. And at that time, I was into those movies a lot. So maybe that's why I didn't go see it. But
came out October 9th.
Okay, so it was in the fall.
Yeah.
So I don't know why I missed it in the theater, and I never did get to see it in the theater. But when we watched it yesterday, I showed it to my daughter for the first time, and it's hard to get her into older films sometimes, but this is one she loved. She loved because of the dialogue and the characters, and the shows she's watching now on the side on her own. You know, she likes to pick clever stuff, and this movie's just full of clever. So she loved it. And I enjoyed watching it again.
So some other, just to give you a rough idea, some other October releases from 1987, Near Dark, Baby Boom, Last Emperor was a couple weeks later, but yeah, there wasn't much around it. I wonder what was going on in your world. You have to
see Near Dark in the theater.
Yeah.
Yeah. But definitely. I didn't see Baby Boom in the theater. So, yeah. I guess that wasn't a theater-going month for me back then.
Right?
Yeah, I mean, that was right in junior year of high school for me, so I wouldn't have been out at the theater. What was the release date? I'm sorry, October? September?
October 87, yeah.
Yeah, so that's probably one reason I wouldn't have been there, but
that's a start.
And this is a movie that has gained its following over a long period of time. Sure, it was good when it was released, but I mean, it wasn't a blockbuster. It didn't do gangbusters at the box office. It did well enough to be profitable, but you know, it didn't do like crazy numbers.
It was very culty, you know,
for a long time. Yeah,
I remember hearing about it long before I actually got a chance to sit down and see it, you know, and you know, people were ranting and raving about it, but it was one of those circumstances where they were talking about it a lot, but it wasn't doing a lot. Like, and it was gone very quickly. So for as much as people talked about it, it was nowhere where you could find it until it came to home, you know, home media. You know, I don't even know what we were calling HBO back then. But, until it came to cable. HBO. Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah, we don't even. Yeah. I forgot about the cable. the term cable. There's so many words for everything today. So yeah, so by the time I saw it, by the time I actually got a chance to sit down and see it, I knew something was people were buzzing about it. It was even at that age, I knew there was a lot of buzz around it, but I didn't know why until I saw it, and then I realized, oh, well, that's why. This is, you know, movie is genius.
Here's another reason you may not have seen it opening weekend late. It only opened in 9 theaters.
That's amazing. I think at that point, too,
that'll do it.
I wasn't on my Rob Reiner kick where Rob Reiner could do no wrong. Right. I think I'd only seen Stand By Me and what came before that. Obviously, Spinal Tap, but something else.
Wait. I
can't remember.
The director of Princess Bride did Spinal Tap?
Yeah.
Oh.
And A Few Good Men.
Few Good Men, American President, Stand By Me. Eclectic. Misery. He had
100% batting average until North. But
When Harry Met Sally.
Oh yeah, that's when I became, I'm like, okay, you gotta see anything by this director.
Right.
It's always good, and he changes genres. And that's what I like, that's why I liked it after the fact, is it's not a movie filled with special effects or grand vistas except in a few shots, but it feels very much embedded in the world it creates. And I thought that was really cool.
That was one of the things that I had put down that I noticed last night, really looking at it for the first time in this way, that the majority of the sets that aren't location shots, like, you know, when they're outside running through the kind of through the landscape.
Yeah.
All of them, the sets weren't created to be realistic. They look like they're like sets for a stage play, you know, and it's shot that way. I thought that was really interesting. And I don't know if that was them trying to just keep with the idea that this was a story being relayed to you.
Like a storybook, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Because, you know, the overarching narrative is the grandpa telling the grandson a story. But I really liked that. I really actually kind of embraced that. You know, every shot, you know, when they're on the ship, when the sword fight area where they fight, you know, where they have the sword fight, all the sets that were created for them, you know, I feel like that they could have been done for a stage play.
I think that's part of why it's so evergreen, is they weren't doing their best at realism in the 80s. They were doing this sort of like cartoon. So you watch it in 1995 and you're like, great. And you watch it in 2004 and you're like, awesome. And you watch it in 2020 and you're like, this is adorable, because it's sort of like outside of time.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. It can't be dated because they didn't shoot it in a way that dated it. Yeah. That's a great point.
Yeah. It's the Rocket Man formula again, you know, since in because of the way you did it, or because of the format and how it was presented to you, it has kind of a universal playability, you know, like as in Rocket Man is not beholden to historical accuracy, you know. There are aspects of Princess Bride that wouldn't be beholden to any, you know, contemporary tropes or signs of age.
Right.
Because of the format that it was presented in.
Right, a bad yeah. mat or a blue screen effect or whatever.
Right. Yeah, or you know, whatever tricks of there are things where you watch an 80s movie and you could tell, okay, this was, even if it wasn't the style of the clothes that people were wearing, you could tell it was made in this era because of certain sensibilities of filmmaking or certain, you know, something in the visual language that is telltale. But if you tell a story as though it's a fairy tale and it's purposely done to be almost look like a stage play, you know, in certain aspects, you can't really, your brain doesn't associate it with any particular kind of style. It kind of becomes a thing unto itself. And that's why it's
right.
Probably got playability for an extended period of time.
Right. When you watch it, you don't think 80s film.
Right.
You just think good film.
Yes.
Which is the best kinds of those kinds of movies. That's how they are. In my research into the backdrop and the sort of the background of this, I found lots of fun stuff. And also, if none of you have read it, this is
fantastic.
This is fantastic.
Yes.
Absolutely amazing.
I can't see what you're referring
it's,
to.
It's Cary Elwes's book.
Oh.
As You Wish.
Okay.
That it's basically a whole thing of him just talking about making the film. And it's, It's absolutely filled with a million stories and anecdotes. Plus, it's also peppered throughout with little bits from all the other people involved with the film, from the producers to all the other, everybody else on the cast. You know, like there's a chapter where he talks about working, you know, the whole shooting with Billy Crystal and Carol Kane, where the Miracle Max and Valerie scene. And, you know, then there's a bunch of other little gray boxes that are little boxed out bits of text from other people talking about them being on set also, you know, and their sort of feelings. He brings a lot into it. It was written with another guy, and I think maybe he probably did the legwork as far as tracking down those other interviews or doing those other interviews about that stuff to include in the book. But it's so much fun to read because it's like, again, it's like getting a free backstage pass to your favorite band and being right. allowed to hang out with them and see how they were.
Just okay. a really well-written.
Yeah.
It's also just a really written book. And the only thing where I was kind of like, about how everyone was there to make a fun movie and nowhere to excise their demons. And I was like, but like, actually sometimes some really good acting comes out of excising demons. So I don't know, but literally everything else about the book I loved. That's my only like,
There's
looking forward to this now.
it's a quick read. You'll get through it in a day or two, but it is just so packed full of fun stuff that like, yeah, again, you read this book and you just end up smiling like the entire time you're reading it, just because again, it takes you right back to the movie and you're like, oh, I get, you know, there's just something good about it. So William Goldman, the writer of the original source novel and the screenplay adaptation, originally tried to get this made back in the 70s. And Arnold Schwarzenegger is who he wanted to play Fezzik. And Arnold also wanted to play Fezzik. This was, you know, back around the Pumping Iron time, so Arnold wasn't really a name yet. He actually had earmarked Andre the Giant because he had seen him wrestle and thought that he would have been a great choice for it. But he could not get a hold of him. He couldn't get someone to, you know, get to him, or he couldn't get a call back from him to talk to him about it. So this ended up falling into development hell for a number of years with multiple studios as the option was bought and resold. And at least two studio heads lost their jobs for unrelated reasons after they had announced that they wanted to make this into a film. And so it kind of got this tag in Hollywood as being A, unfilmable, and kind of bad luck. So it ended up just getting sat on for a number of years. And eventually, Goldman bought the rights back himself. He bought the option rights back from the studio that owned them because he was tired of waiting around. And he said, well, I'll do what I can myself.
I'll do it myself.
And so that's when he went sent back and wrote the screenplay and then started shopping that around. Before that, some other directors who were interested and initially tied to this project at different times: Francois Truffaut, oh, wow. Robert Redford, Norman Jewison, and Richard Lester. Francois Truffaut making this film would have been really interesting.
Yeah.
So Cary Elwes and Robin Wright apparently were smitten with each other from day one.
Well,
and their genuine interest in each other was one of the parts, obviously, that made that relationship work so well on screen. It was funny that Elwes was saying that during their last shooting scene together, which was that final kiss on horseback at the very end, that they kept making up, one of the two of them kept making up reasons to do more takes, like saying they screwed something up and needed to do another take because they didn't want shooting to end. They're like trying to extend it as long as they could.
They never dated though, did they?
No, they've just, and to this day, they've remained very close friends. And they're in the book, it's funny, they're kind of both very effusive about the other one, but they, you know, how amazing, you know, he thought it was, she was amazing. It's funny that she came in, she's marked as introducing her on this movie, but this wasn't her first movie. She actually did a movie before this.
Which one? Some with Sean Penn?
No, long before she met Sean Penn. She wouldn't meet Sean Penn until State of Grace.
That was 87?
what? State of Grace?
Yeah.
No, or 90.
Yeah.
But she was on Santa Barbara, the soap opera, for a couple of years. That's where kind of she had kind of gotten her acting
chops from.
Yeah. And that when she came in and everyone kind of knew that this was now, I don't even know if the other film had been released yet or not, but when they hired her for this and, you know, and she got the role and she came in, everyone was like, oh, you know, geez. And the amount of people, the amount of actors she was working with years of experience, you know, they were all kind of, you know, he was kind of worried for her. He's like, but from day one, he goes, she was more professional or just as professional as everybody working here. So we quickly became very, you know, very relaxed around her, and she had no problems. One of the things about Andre I thought was fun, they apparently were worried about him being able to speak his dialogue clearly enough. So the producer and Rob Reiner had recorded all of his lines onto tapes, and he would, on non-shooting time, he would walk around with headphones on listening to them saying the lines over and over again so he could get a feel for how they were supposed to sound. And by the time he was able to shoot all of his scenes, he had nailed all the lines well enough that they had to do no overdubs on his voice, which is great. So Uma Thurman was originally considered for the lead in this movie, but was found to be too exotic looking and not quite plain enough for Buttercup, which is interesting. Courtney Cox and Meg Ryan read for the part as well. And Goldman thought that Carrie Fisher would have been the perfect choice as Buttercup.
By 87? I don't know. I don't know if she would have been 20 years old in 77. She was 20 years old 10 years earlier. So I don't know.
Late bloomer.
I don't know if that would have worked. As Buttercup, I mean, she could have done the role, you know? I'm just talking about, like,
getting that feeling of the character.
Yeah.
And then, apparently, Whoopi Goldberg campaigned for the role.
The Princess Buttercup?
Yeah. Very interestingly.
Yeah.
Christopher Reeve was shortly considered for the role of Wesley, which I found interesting, but I think he's too big. I think he would have been kind of almost too manly to play that part.
He's tall. He was tall.
He's Superman.
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
He is Superman.
That's another problem.
That's what's wrong with that, you know? I think the suit would have got in the way, you know? That would have been problematic.
It would have shown underneath his neck was open.
Yeah.
Yeah. He had that problem with anything after all the Superman movies, and then he did what's that movie with Morgan Freeman? Street Smart? Am I remembering that right?
Yeah. And he also did Death Trap with Michael Caine.
Which one?
Death Trap.
Death Trap.
I think with Michael Caine.
The Clue ripoff?
That was earlier, though. That was 80, right?
Well, it was after Superman.
It was after the first one, yeah. But that's good, too. He was able to do dramatic roles and shed the Superman guys, but this is an adventure movie, so
yeah. The problem I had with him is that he was always Superman. Like, he just, like, hey, look at that Superman in Victorian times, you know? And like,
yeah,
it's
yeah.
Hey, check problem. It out. Superman's got an axe, you know, in Death Trap. You know, Superman's killing people, but it's still he was Superman. That was his ultimate problem is he was so perfect for pretty much what was his first role that he could never get out of that, you know.
Oh, Somewhere in Time, though.
That's what I'm talking about. Into Victoria, like this. Oh, look, Superman.
Yeah. Death Trap was That's right. I got you,
Stoya. I know you're a bit of a wrestling fan nowadays. Do you go back and look at any of the historical end of the WWE back when they were WWF?
I've seen the older stuff, not like extensively. I've seen a couple of Andre the Giant matches. But you know, for me, he was the big guy in the Princess Bride. It's just, I saw him.
It's a Superman effect
at such a young age. That it's like, oh, the big Princess Bride is wrestling. Yeah.
Well,
it's like Roddy McDowell will always be Cornelius, no matter what I ever see him in. You know, that's just the first impression is pretty much who that person is for the rest of our lives.
Yeah. Yeah. He, his favorite, he said the favorite thing he had about making this film was the fact that, and he was able to find this to a smaller extent, or I guess it's to a larger extent, smaller extent, later on in his life when he bought his ranch. The thing he liked about making this movie was that everyone just treated him like a normal person. Like he was just another guy on the set. He was just another guy. He wasn't Andre the Giant. You know, he wasn't this thing that everyone had to be constantly looking at and asking about and touching and he was just he was just another actor. And I know that he searched long and hard in his life for that, because, you know, eventually he was able to buy a ranch outside this small town, and I want to say Colorado, or so it was somewhere out west, and he bought this small ranch or big ranch outside a small town, but everyone in the town knew that he lived there, mm-hmm. and he would come into town for supplies or for groceries or whatever, and they would all just be like, oh, hey, Andre, how's it going? And like they said, the town treated him exactly the way he wanted to be treated, which was just like any other person just walking around. Which was something he hadn't been able to find his entire life.
It's I mean, I had the normal years, but then as an adult, like, people just treat you differently, and
right.
That's the thing with Serbia. They're just like, hey, what's up? Like, you want to bum a cigarette? Oh, you quit. It's probably better for you.
But now. And I've been out with you a couple of times. We've gone to dinner and been out at different places publicly. Do you still get people coming up to you and wanna, and you know?
It's really more that they get in touch afterwards. Like they'll be like, "Hey, I saw you at the LAX Gate 51. We were reading a book. I wasn't close enough to see what book you were reading." It's wow. And that's like a particular kind of unsettling.
Yeah, I was going to say that's almost the word I was going to use. That's a little,
A to not only reach out, but then to give that much detail about, and it's
you
like,
were wearing you were wearing a blue sweater and red shoes.
Your one sock had fallen.
Yeah. You're walking with a slight limp. Are you okay? Like,
And it's just like, I would have believed you, right?
Yeah. Without the details.
Yes, I was at LAX at Gate 50.
I've been like, okay, but to go, the gate number and the like.
Yeah.
And then like in the US when people do like the like, pictures and like armchair paparazzi and like all that kind of stuff, if you try to pull, hey, you're like treating me like an animal at the zoo, a lot of the time they feel very entitled and they can get like kind of aggressive. And Serbia, the one time it's happened, I was like, hey, that wasn't particularly cool to shoulder, and they were like, you're right, I wasn't thinking, I'm sorry. So it's just like different.
Oh, absolutely.
In America, that would be a full-blown confrontation here in the States. It's like, right. Hey, it would have been a little bit.
Yeah, it would have been, how dare you not let me take a picture with you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
How dare you not appreciate my appreciation of you?
Yeah.
You want a moment to wipe the quail off your face before I get my selfie? I was eating quail in Los Angeles.
So this must have been dinner, I'm assuming. Not many people eat quail for breakfast.
She plucked one from the sky and just started chowing down on
during
her.
Dinner.
Gotcha.
Bit the head off.
At a table.
Were you outside? At a restaurant.
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah, you see that's a, you know, and I've done a lot of work, as you know, as security for famous and semi-famous people. And it never ceases to amaze me. You know, I have a really close friend of mine who was on the show Face Off on Sci-Fi Channel, the makeup challenge show. Yeah. And he was on the second season of the show. And this was 12 years ago at this point. And people still, Like, we'll be out someplace, or we'll be at a comic convention. Clearly he'll get recognized more often, but we'll be at a show or something, and or even just be out going to dinner somewhere, and someone will be like, "Hey, you're that guy who was on Face Off," you know, and he's always just like, "Yeah, yeah, I am." And he goes, he's always very like, can you get a picture? He's like, "Yeah, sure, why not? You know, what do I care?" But it's different. I fully understand being on both sides of the table here. It's a lot different with people in your profession. I think that the fans in your profession, I don't want to say act more entitled, but I think the fact that they spend so much time watching you naked and doing things that most people consider very private, they just feel like, well, how could she possibly be ever upset by anything normal that happens to her?
Yeah.
Because, you know, she does this on camera for a living. So yeah. why, like the
exhibition switch is always on, you know, like, right. Like every tickle is allowed.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And so I'm like deeply enjoying the anonymity of masks. still getting called though. And I've over the years, I've learned how to dress to avoid attention. And one of my friends, she was living in Paris for a while, I visited her. We hadn't seen each other in person in a few years. And she was like, "What are you wearing?" And, you know, she's wearing a whole outfit. And we went out and out on the streets of Paris all day. And I didn't get very much trouble. And about a year later, she was like, "You know, I went out with you and life's a lot easier." And I'm like, "Yeah." you have to go like,
right,
either super slobby, invisible, or dressed to the absolute nines. And like, those are like the things you can get through life without just like random men being like,
Yeah, we're mostly awful. I understand.
Yeah. Hashtag not all potatoes.
Yeah,
yeah.
I think that's one of the nice. things that's so charming about Wesley is like, he's just very quietly there. He's there and he's interested, but he's not forcing himself on anyone. And it's very like endearing. It's like, "Oh, it's not a scary man."
one of the fun connections I made last night that I actually never had before, and I used to think about this when I was younger. You know, they make the big point about at the beginning how when he says "as you wish" all the time, he's really saying "I love you." And at the end last night, I think, was the first time I realized when the grandfather turns and says "as you wish" to the grandson as he's leaving, it's essentially what he's doing. Where I always, it's funny because my movie mind, and Latham, I think you'll understand this, I always sort of thought, are they trying to say that the grandfather was actually Wesley? Like, I thought that was part of the trick. It's like he was reading this book, but it was actually his story. But, he just obviously said it in a different time, but I always made that connection as opposed to the, what it really means, where he's just telling his grandson that he loves him. I really like that.
You know, what's really strange is my favorite scene in that film, then I love the whole film, but my absolute, the thing I come back to every time is when he's done reading the story and he takes like maybe a solid 3 to 5 minutes looking around.
Getting his jacket, saying, checking his pockets,
saying, "Okay,
doing the grandpa stuff."
And he doesn't even realize he's saying "okay" 100 times before he trots out the door. My favorite, awesome. Peter Falk is just ridiculous in this film.
It's so real. It doesn't even seem like a real scene. The scenes with him don't seem like real scenes. It just seems like they're just like a camera on a guy.
"You're sick, I'll humor you."
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is this a kissing book?
When I was
book?
A kid, yeah. I thought that guy's Matlock.
Close. Very close. He he and Matlock should have teamed up. They would have, crime would have ended in the free world.
That's
the two of them got together.
The rubber band
and the paperclip.
Yeah. It would have been the original Law and Order, right?
That's right.
Peter Falk would have brought him in and Matlock would have put him in jail. Oh man. Now I want to see that.
Yeah, right?
Maybe someone can do a cartoon.
They probably do a deep fake.
Yeah, you could do it now. Oh my god, that stuff is scary. Yeah, there's too much about that movie. Keep going.
So
Mandy, I start to wax nostalgic.
I know, right? Well, I'd say that's what we're here for.
Yeah.
Mandy Patinkin has stated this role is his personal favorite over the entire course of his career. He says on a daily basis, he has people come up to him and say, you know, hello, my name is Inigo Montoya, and do the whole thing. And
kill my father, prepare to die.
He says he never tires of it. It has to be finished. He says, yes, it does. I'm sorry. He says he never tires of it, and it always makes him smile. And he goes, and apparently he was interviewed once, and he said, I can't believe that I got to be in The Wizard of Oz. You know what I mean? And he's right to a certain extent for a different generation.
Yeah,
this is a very Wizard of Oz-esque film. Mm-hmm. Not only in its structure, but also in just the way, the way it feels. I think it actually, the pace of it is actually better than Wizard of Oz. I've seen this movie 25, 30 times. And in watching it last night, when the ending came, I literally had to glance at the clock again because I couldn't believe that 90 minutes had passed. Like this movie flows so quick. And like I said, every scene, but there's, and to Latham's point, it's a trim script. There's no meat. There's no fat on there whatsoever. There's no empty space where you're like, they could really do without this scene, or they could really, do without that. It's like it never comes to that once in this film.
That's right.
I do not mean to pry, but you wouldn't happen to have six fingers on your left hand, would you?
It's a very strange way to start a conversation. he's like, I had to ask. that during that scene when he's like, who are you? I really must know. And he's like,
you'll be used to disappointment.
Prepare you for disappointment. He's like, okay. every single line.
I admitted you're better than I am. Then why are you smiling? Because I know something you do not. I am not left-handed.
And it was so funny, and I never noticed until I actually read, and this was pointed out before I watched the movie. So, they both start the sword fight telling each other that they're left-handed, right?
Mm-hmm.
But Inigo is wearing his sword on his left hip, so that would mean he's actually right-handed.
Right-handed, yeah.
But if you look, Wesley's sword is on his right hip, showing that he's left-handed. So he was actually much more in with the ruse and probably knew that Montoya was actually right-handed and was playing with him.
Ah, it's funny.
And I never noticed that before. And it's funny, when Wesley goes to draw his sword, he actually reaches behind his back and pulls the sword out that way with his left hand. It's a really interesting way to draw. So Liam Neeson read for Fezzik. Which I found incredibly interesting. But then apparently when Rob Reiner found out that he was only 6'4", he scoffed at him.
Oh, man.
it's like my dating habits.
Based upon on height
my best friend is 6 foot. Yeah, my best friend is 6 foot flat. And he's like, I just don't, people under 6 foot are really men. And I'm like, well, my vagina agrees with you.
Kareem Abdul-Jabbar was also interested in the role, but his NBA schedule did not allow for it. Somebody else they talked to was Richard Kyle, Jaws from the James Bond films. He would have been,
I see that.
Had to be an imposing figure.
Speaking of remakes, I wonder if you have a version that was just cast completely differently, or like revisit characters in their middle age or something. I guess it's been too long to do middle age in their elderly times.
I think that'd be better. Then redo it. No point to redo it. So.
Do a sequel?
You mean almost like, almost like a sequel, but with the characters where they are now?
Yeah.
In an all-new story?
Yeah.
No, I agree. I think that would be far more interesting. Especially if you can get, you know, the majority of the cast back.
Yeah.
Which you could. I mean, the only actors who are dead are the clergyman, the king, Fezzik, and I think that's it.
Carol Kane alive?
Carol Kane's alive.
Yeah, everybody's still alive.
All the main cast are, except for Andre.
Nice.
The guy who played the king, that was his last film before he passed away.
Oh.
And Peter Cook died.
He was not very old, though.
The prince's father.
The old man.
Prince.
Yeah,
the king. Sorry. The old man.
Yeah, Chris Sarandon is still alive.
Yeah, Chris Sarandon is
very
alive.
Much so.
And he looks great, too. I just saw him like on doing like press for something recently. And he looked great.
Yeah.
You know?
He grew into it.
Yeah, he really did. His hair's all salt and peppery, and he's got a really great look to him now. So this was fun. The cinematographer on this film was Adrian Biddle, a very well-known name, shot a lot of great movies over the course of his, unfortunately, very short career because he died very young.
Oh.
He died of a heart attack at like 54. Just awful. Oh. But this was his second director of photography job. Anyone know his first?
No.
Aliens.
Wow.
Wow.
Wait a minute. That's a first time.
That's
Aliens is a first time on the job.
First time cinematographer.
Amazing.
No.
Like go to school or thing?
And you're working with James Cameron. Your first job is with James Cameron on.
I didn't dig deeper than that into it. My guess is he probably was an assistant DP on a lot of stuff or working with other people, but this was his first full gig.
And how much of it was Cameron, you know, himself?
Right.
You know, because I mean, he's very hands-on, so he might have done a lot of that work and delegated, you know, as opposed to, so this might be like the guy's actual first job. Yeah.
Yeah, Ridley Scott sets most of it up. He doesn't actually turn the camera on and off.
Mm-mm. But no, he does.
He sets a lot of it up, yeah. So there was a real Dread Pirate Roberts. Bartholomew Roberts was known as Black Bart in the Caribbean in the 18th century and is considered by most to be the most successful pirate of all time.
Oh, wow.
So the sword fight took 3 minutes and 10 seconds, takes up 3 minutes and 10 seconds in the film. Took them almost a week to shoot it.
I can believe that.
That's the part about, like, you know, and I can't wait till I hope someday I get the luxury of being able to actually be on a movie set for the course of an actual entire film shoot. But that's the part that always amazes me is the, and I know that there's tons of downtime as opposed to the actual setting up of everything and getting everything done. It's not like, okay, here's our set. It's lit. Let's just take a camera and go and shoot everything. I mean, if you're shooting a film in that style, that's one thing. But when you're shooting it from a generally fixed locations on a number of different shots, there's all this work that goes into what results in a few minutes worth of time. You know, the chase sequence, the big highway chase sequence from the second Matrix film. What was it they shot for 17 days or something for 7.5 minutes worth of footage or something like that?
Yeah.
I mean, I mean, on a closed piece of highway. So they had access to it the entire time.
Yeah. There's a movie called Underworld with, you know, Kate.
Yeah. The vampire one.
Yeah. Done by Len Wiseman. And in the commentary, he said that the highway scene in The Matrix cost more than the entire film. Underworld.
Yeah.
Wow, it's almost not double, but 1.25 more than the entire film that they made. That's how much money they burned on that. It's an excellent sequence, though. They got their money's worth out of it.
Yeah, for sure. It's great.
And all the, so Elvis and Patinkin did all their own stunts in that whole sword fight sequence. The only thing that wasn't done by one of the actors was Carrie's flip on the bar.
The Jim Cotta move?
Yeah, exactly. The Jim Cotta move. Exactly.
Who are you?
I must know.
What's this high bar doing in this?
I know, right? Just random bar stretched across between two rocks.
That was a little bit out of place there, but better than a pommel horse in the middle of the forest.
And so I used to listen to this this score a lot. I love the soundtrack to this movie. Mark Knopfler did an amazing job. He agreed to do the score for this only if Rob Reiner had the hat that he wore in Spinal Tap somewhere in the film with it. So it's in the background in the kid's bedroom if you look carefully. I did spot it last night.
Awesome.
So Miracle Max and Valerie were named after the writer William Goldman's parents. Always fun.
Nice.
And Christopher Guest, of course, in Spinal Tap is the guitarist whose amp goes up to 11. And in this movie has 11 fingers. So
yeah, that's right. Really
weird connection there.
That's funny.
So yeah, that's
not to 50.
I mean, I have a few other oddball things, you know, we could probably talk about as far as the movie goes. But that's all my notes. Does anyone have anything else that we didn't bring up, Leigh?
Well, I don't have any notes either. I'm just thinking back to watching it.
Well, while you're thinking, Hassan, do you have anything? Any last bits?
I honestly don't think the rodents of unusual size exist.
That's fair.
I'll add that.
It's funny. They've actually been referenced in multiple other properties across multiple media. They're referenced in a video game called Borderlands. In Borderlands 2, they're referenced.
I don't know. You know, the movie is... It's another one. We keep doing these like monsters, you know, these monster movies where whatever you want to say about them, it's hard to contextualize in like a couple of lines of genuine dialogue. You know, it's probably one of the most, next to the movie Snatch for me, you know, one of the most quotable movies in human history.
Right.
That's probably one of the reasons I've seen it so many times. Also one of the reasons I remember it so vividly, even without having watched it last night. It's just because, you know, it lives in its dialogue. It's there's not a lot of action in it. There's no sweeping epic scenes or big battles or anything like that. It's mostly people in rooms talking to each other with this like really sharp, in almost intuitive sounding dialogue amongst themselves that is completely out of place with the setting that they're in, which is another thing that's really wonderfully anachronistic about the piece in general. And it is absolutely the definition of delightful. You know, there's nothing offensive about it. There's nothing challenging about it. You know, it's just a story about a fairy tale being read to a man's sick grandson, you know, in the process of him, you know, coming out of it, which kind of lends to maybe the kid was sicker than the movie lets on, and he's just coming out of the woods or something, you know, so the grandfather comes by and reads him, you know, theoretically reads him an entire book, and that's a heaping tome that he's holding there. I mean, the movie is shorter than the book that he's looking. It looks like he's holding the Bible, basically.
Yeah.
So the idea that he's going to come back again the next day and read the whole story to the kid again, you know, lends to a lot. And I've had my grandfather read me stories. You know, it hits on so many levels. So it's just. I hate to say it's just a great story and it's a great movie and I love it, but I mean, that really covers it perfectly.
Yeah. Perfect. So Latham, did anything else?
No, not really. It's just, it doesn't feel like an 80s movie when you watch it, but I'm glad it's part of the 80s canon of the best films of that decade, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. What was your, rating on it?
3.5.
Originally?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's what I gave it. I gave it high marks. I just, you know, you need a little bit more personal emotion for me to get higher than that. I mean, it's a great movie. There's nothing wrong with it. It's
No. 3.5 from you is
that's pretty high.
That's a high ranking.
Yeah.
Any lost ducks, Stoya?
No, I think it's a wonderful movie and everyone should watch it. And I'm very curious about this table reading version that is soon to occur.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll be interested to see how that plays out and kind of who they've got to play what. So that'll be fun. All right. So there we will.
Okay, what's this tubes joke?
Uh-oh.
What's that?
What's the down the tubes joke?
Oh, down the tubes is the segment that we talk about posters. It's not a joke. It's the name of the piece.
Yeah, the tubes of the posters come in. We're going into the tubes.
It's funny. You freaked me out. You unmuted it remotely, and I'm like, she's not back. Where is that coming from?
Embodied voice. Yeah.
The guilty pleasure we did for Dean. It was a horror movie called Tourist Trap, and it involves this, the killer has telekinetic power, and he ends up making mannequins come to life, but there's all these shots of these mannequins, their jaws drop open, and they make this sort of sound, and it's nice and creepy. But so Dean, apparently, in case you guys didn't know, Stoya has worked with Dean on a few different things. She wrote a comic story for Heavy yes. Metal that Dean illustrated. She's also performed in a couple of plays that he's done. So she and Dean are well acquainted. But in case you didn't know Stoya, and you can mess with him on this later because this will be fun, especially if he doesn't know that you know, he's apparently afraid of mannequins.
Oh.
So that'll be fun to take advantage of at some point.
Yeah.
and has never seen the movie Mannequin, we found out.
Yeah.
Okay.
Everybody's got their quirks.
Yeah, because he's afraid of them.
Yeah, and that's what he said. It's one of the reasons he likes this movie is because mannequins freak him out. So it's like there's a whole lot of mannequin stuff in this movie. So he likes the fact that this movie kind of creeps him out even now.
Okay.
It's a, you know, cheap 70s slasher film, but it's more creepy than, you know, truly scary for him just because of his own personal connection to it. And you didn't really have any sort of guilty pleasure-y kind of movie? A movie that you like to watch, but you know that's kind of bad?
No.
No?
Not that I can think of. Let me check my iTunes here.
What have you watched recently?
I watched Knives Out.
Great movie.
Yeah.
Still haven't seen that.
It's free on Prime right now. It's really good.
I have it.
Okay.
You know, I just haven't. Ryan Johnson's on my list.
Right. Oh, hey, and also.
No, Heathers and Tu Wong Fu, Thanks for Julie Newmar, are fantastic pieces of cinema.
Yeah.
And I don't think guilty pleasure applies at all.
Right. No, you're right. One of the guests we have coming up in a few weeks, picked his guilty pleasure film. Critically, you can call it a failure, but it's a movie that I've championed for since it came out as being a great movie. That, you know, it's just one of those movies that people just didn't seem to dig. It's I guess it's a horror movie, it's called The Hidden.
Okay.
You remember that one, Lai?
Oh, man. With, The Hidden.
Yeah.
Kyle MacLachlan?
Yes.
Is it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's a good movie. I'll be happy to watch that.
Yeah, I know.
I watched What We Do in the Shadows.
The movie? Oh, yes. My God. Had me rolling on the floor, that movie.
It's so good. It's so funny.
I haven't seen any of the TV show yet. So I've been...
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
What are you doing to yourself?
I know.
That TV show is ridiculous. As the movie is very funny. The TV show is an extension of it, yeah. And because it's a TV show, they get to go further with it.
Right.
And most of the characters from the movie are in the TV show.
Right.
Like they pay visits, you know? So.
Let's go down the tubes.
And again, the internet is not something that you just dump something on. It's not a big truck. It's a series of tubes.
All right. So starting off here. We've got when I was looking up the posters for this, the regular full release poster, U.S. number 1A. I always in my head remembered the main poster as being this basic background, but the silhouette of him and her. But that wasn't until later that they changed that. This was actually the original poster.
It was just like the grandfather and the son.
Exactly. And for some reason, and it's one of those things that just, you know, your memory sets things in place that, you know, aren't real. The second image is a painting by...
I think when watching it on cable, you tend to lose that framing of the story because you don't usually start from the very beginning. You come in mid-fantasy time.
Right.
Also, I think my posters are out of order.
Ah.
So what's the name of the next one?
The next one should be 1A. It's a painting. Yeah, it's a painting by Maxfield Parrish.
Daybreak.
Yes.
So this is the inspiration for the movie poster, actually.
All right.
I don't know if any of you are familiar with Maxfield Parrish's work.
Amazing.
He was an amazing artist from the mid century, and he did the majority of his work in the kind of the 20s, 30s, and 40s, and it was all a lot like this, where it was like these sort of almost idyllic shots. His use of light and color to convey this sort of highlighting effect that he does in his work was kind of his trademark. I'm a huge fan of Maxfield Parrish's work. His story ended somewhat sadly. I don't think he's still alive, but a number of years before he passed away, he had a stroke, and after the stroke, he was unable to paint the way he did before, obviously, and he was not able to. A similar thing happened to Frank Frazetta. Frank Frazetta had a stroke in his 60s, maybe.
Yeah.
And he was unable to use, he was right-handed, and he was kind of unable to utilize that hand to draw properly after his stroke. So he taught himself to draw with his left hand. And so basically anything after his stroke, if you look at it, there's a certain amount of unsurety compared to obviously the pre-stroke work, but you can still very clearly see that it's Frank Frazetta, and he worked very hard to kind of get back to that level. Maxfield Parrish could not get his head around that, and he just quit painting. He felt that if he couldn't paint the way that he saw in his head, that it wasn't worth doing for him. And I always found that incredibly sad.
Well, it is. But, you found it that way because it is sad.
Yeah, no, I know. But it's one of those things that you find out about, and it just, you're just like, oh.
Yeah, it almost makes you regret that you looked it up, you know?
but you know what? When it comes to stuff like that, though, I like knowing
information. Me too, but
like that. But yeah, I get your point.
Yeah, there are times I've looked up, like, I've heard a song, like, oh, man, this is an awesome song. Whatever happened to this guy, you know, or whatever. Oh, and you look it up, and then you find out, you know, terrible things, and you're like, man, I was better off, just liking the song.
Right. So the next poster, the U.S. video release, which is number 2, that's the image that I always remember as being the poster image for this. That's, and apparently it was, you know, they didn't bring this up until for the video release. They replaced the grandfather grandson image with those two silhouetted. So, but that's the one I always remember.
Yeah, because that's the most iconic thing about the film, right? Is that relationship between the two of them.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I definitely think so.
Yeah. Almost forget about Fred Savage and Peter Falk until you start the movie again.
Right.
And then you're like, oh, okay.
Oh, like, oh, that's right.
It's like Stoya said about the
there's a whole thing right here that I forgot about. The next is the U.S. 30th anniversary video release poster. Or actually, this was a One Day in Cinemas poster. This isn't for the video release. This is for an event.
Photo poster.
Yeah, an event that they have. Yeah. What the current classic way of promoting something is throw a bunch of images together from a movie and hope people dig it. The next one's really, really great. It's a painted UK quad. I like this one a lot. You know, the likenesses, the likenesses aren't spot on, but it's a lot of fun because it kind of throws in a lot more elements of the movie.
They're good enough. You know who they are.
Sure.
You know who's being depicted.
Yeah.
Fezzik's hands are in kind of a grasping pose, but they're not actually around anything. I just noticed that.
Yeah.
The portcullis was supposed to be 6 inches to the right or left.
Yes.
It's like, whoops.
And they're like, ship it. Just ship it.
We don't have time to fix it. Send it in. It's printed. This next one, Italian, oh, wow. Italy, the number five.
A little overboard okay. here.
Here well, we go.
The Italian one.
It's Conan.
Is a problem.
Well, so here's the thing. The
center, they got the rodents in there.
The rodents and her, and even, you know, the lower, the or like the mid left image of them and confronting the rodents. That's the Atlantean sword from Conan.
Yeah, why is Conan in the middle of the...
It's bad, dude. It's bad.
They almost got everything right, except for someone like, you know what? I'm putting Conan in there, and I don't care who has a problem with
it. Yeah, yeah.
It's really funny. It's so crazy.
They can't get their money back. they paid for this poster. I'm
yeah, Conan, that's right. So. I saw this, and I'm like, wait, what? and then the German poster is sort of a weird amalgamation of images from both the Italian poster and just a photo drop-in of the silhouette of those two in front of the Atlantean sword.
The German one is also bad.
Yes. Yes. terrible. You'll find that in most cases, a lot of the European poster images, as we go through them on movies, that they've gotten... They have access to all these assets, and they just sort of kind of glop things together unless they actually had someone commissioned to do a piece for their release.
And wouldn't it have been more like an Ego sword would have been more appropriate, right?
Yeah.
And a fencing, more ornate. A fencing
sword, right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Because there's a big deal about that sword.
Yes.
You know, that's another big iconic thing in the film. Wow.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And then the last of the official releases is a poster for Japan, which is
not good.
Funny because it, again, comprises still images from the film and also like promotional stills. Because the stacked three of them, it's just clearly not from the movie.
It's
and then they put the. I think
this is delightfully Japanese.
Yeah, oh yeah. No. It fits right in with their style of film poster making. Absolutely.
They drop the grandfather and the grandson in non-photo blue, just as a non-photo blue silhouette.
Yeah, they just silhouetted it and flipped it.
Yes.
The grandfather's on the left now.
Well, they read from.
Oh, good point. They go the other way, right?
Mm-hmm. From left to right, I think.
So now we go into Aaron Jasinski.
Oh, right to left.
And a lot of this is stuff that I found in my searching around. Yeah.
This is fantastic.
Right?
Except Columbo. I don't know why.
The likeness is he's got a little.
But I mean, this is Columbo. He's got the.
I know.
Okay, so I'm not the only person. Oh, but that was Matlock. So, okay, look, they're all the same.
Right. All those middle-aged white guy detectives.
Everybody else is movie appropriate except for Peter Falk.
That's a little weird. I agree.
I guess he had to have been done as a nod. Had to have been done as a joke.
Yeah, I think someone just fritzed out and started painting. I mean, I don't.
Because it's fantastic.
It's creative.
And Vizzini is blindfolded.
Yeah, what's
with the glass of wine, and then with Wesley writing "As You Wish." I mean, the guy took liberties, for sure, but and some of them are a little interesting. But yeah, it's a little odd. And then there's
Fred Savage is the cherub.
Yes,
I think those two cherubs are Fred Savage.
Well, then look at Miracle Max. He's holding a mutton, lettuce, and tomato sandwich.
Yeah.
and Wesley is nurturing one of the. Rodents of unusual size.
Yes, I just noticed that. I just saw the nose. Realized that he was hugging one. You know.
Oh, man. All right. Well, that's one for the ages.
The next one's a little more straightforward. Alex Zablosky.
I really like this one.
Yeah, it's cool. Yeah, I like the stair-stepping effect of him rising off the bed, you know, as the focal point for the movie. I like this.
Yeah.
Dropped.
So the next one, Latham, you'll recognize, by Andrew DeGraff.
Yep, from Cinemax. Yep.
Stoya and Hassan, if you don't know, there is a guy named Andrew DeGraff that wrote a book a few years ago called Cinemax. And what he has done is he has gone back to, I don't know how many are in the book, 20 or 30. 20 or 30 major pop culture touch point films. You know, Indiana Jones and Raiders of the Lost Ark, you know, all sorts of those. He does these intricate drawings with maps of the paths that all the characters in the film take. So if you follow all those lines, you can figure out the colors.
You can do the whole movie.
Yes, you can figure out who is who in the colors and then how they go through and where they go. And then you can follow them throughout the entire film on this map. The amount of thought and work that has gone into these is stunning. And there's so much fun just to sit and look at.
The Breakfast Club one is great. It's just like... it's really neat how they do the geography of the school. It's really cool.
Right. And he draws it all in like the, in a kind of a three-quarter ISO view and then draws in all the lines of all the track of all the characters.
That's wonderful. That's beyond. That's going to take me hours to study that.
Yeah.
I want to go through that with a fine-tooth comb.
It's pretty neat. And this image is actually pretty big, so you can actually blow this up pretty large, so you can get a pretty close look on stuff without it fuzzing out too bad. Next is an artist named Chelsea Lowe. She's done work for us before. Very just standard postery.
Really nice, though.
Yeah. Yeah, she does really nice work. Mm-hmm. She does. She actually does a lot of, besides like movie and TV poster stuff, she does a lot of wildlife portraits that are absolutely gorgeous. She has a series of African animal portraits that are really beautiful.
Thanks.
Okay.
And then this next one by Isa maybe Anafada. This is just beautiful. Just
it's stunning.
There's so much work in this.
Wow.
Yeah,
and they're just that you look at the border and everything. There's just so much detail and everything.
This is incredible.
Looks like a passion project, too. Like mm-hmm. you know,
yeah.
Like,
oh well, clearly
you don't do this on commission. You know, you don't. I mean,
right?
You could, but this is above and beyond.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
Next one is an artist named Kevin Tiernan. Works in a clearly much more simplified style, but. Kevin's stuff is always fun for me. Kevin's a good guy, so I always like looking at his work. The next one, Christopher McClanahan. Similar in a sense to the Cinemaps one, where it tries to tell kind of the whole story in one shot. There's a whole bunch of, if you look closely, there's a whole bunch of kind of windows in the castle showing all the different scenes that take place in the castle throughout the, and then kind of working your way back to that. So
clever.
Mm-hmm. Then we have Kyle James. This is one of the first ones I actually ran across because when it looked really small on my Google search, it looked more photographic than it actually is.
Looks like a book cover would work as a book cover, like a children's book.
I agree. It's just simple enough, but it's still got some fine detail. The next one, Mark Welzer, distinctly 60s feel and look.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
Right?
Yeah, it's pretty great.
It's fun. I was reading in some background about the movie, and they were talking about Wesley's outfit and how they modeled it after Zorro, but obviously without the cape.
Right.
Because they didn't want to have to deal with that.
Yeah, but this if you didn't notice it before, it
yes.
is... blatantly obvious in this piece.
Exactly.
The influence.
Yeah.
And the rodents of unusual size to the right there almost looks like wolf of a normal size. But he's got six-figured man, machine.
You can see the three of them.
Yeah.
Three of them.
That's great. That's really great. This next one is by Matthew Hirons. He's another guy.
Oh, that's nice.
Another guy we work with. Pretty regularly.
This looks like a genuine movie poster layout, though.
Yeah, it does. Like he just needs to drop his credit block in, right?
Yeah, room for the title card and everything.
Yep, I agree. Very nicely done. This next one was a Mondo release by Matthew Peak, who is the son of Bob Peak, who's the one who did all the art that we looked at for the Excalibur posters, who did all the release. Man. This is his son. So, but yeah, this is, you know, again, this is this could easily be a legitimate official release poster. Mm-hmm. I really like the fact that it's got like a almost like a colored pencil feel to it, as opposed to being super tight and super, you know, super defined.
Yeah, angular.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just fun. I like the little slightly deco-ish style of the hair kind of curling around, you know, slightly Mooka-esque. Next is Patrick Conan. Again, another kind of typical poster layout.
Yeah, all the highlight beats.
Next is Philip Ellering. This was done as a commission for someone specifically, but they went ahead and posted it online anyway. This is kind of fun. I like the way that all the elements are, you know, obviously come together to form a heart. You know, he's got this one includes the shrieking eels, so. Which weren't actually in the original book. That was an addition just for the film. The shrieking eels did not make their presence in the book. Which I have not read. So that was something I forgot to ask everybody. Has anyone read Goldman's original novel?
I have not. It's one of the things I mean to do, but I have not.
I have.
You have? Oh, good. You know, out of all of us, I would have thought that you would be the one who would have read it. So how do you feel about the novel as compared to the movie adaptation?
They're both equally wonderful, but I rewatch The Princess Bride much more frequently than I reread.
Because like some of the things that I just read about, like some of the things that take place, like...
That's a very diplomatic way of saying I like the movie better, by the way. She found a very, very diplomatic way of, I'm not going to say good or bad, but...
Well, no, I mean, it's, you know, you can enjoy something and you can bite off in an hour and a half as opposed to spending a day or two days reading.
That too.
That's, you know.
The kind of lives we live today.
I think that is the thing. Like, a book is much more of a time commitment.
Right. But, like, some of the things that they, you know, that they loosened up on, like, as far as the movie goes, like, I read that when Inigo kills Rugen in the book, that he actually does cut his heart out, which is what Rugen did to his father, and that Rugen actually dies of fright, as opposed to just kind of giving him the same five wounds that he had given, you know, that Rugen had given him.
Right.
So I'm looking forward to actually sitting down and reading
fright and blood loss.
Yeah, yeah, well, slightly changes the tone of the film. Yeah, I think.
Yeah, you know, turns it into Temple of Doom.
Yeah.
Which was also
Shivaram.
I do not like this Disney stuff.
I was just going to say, imagine if it were a Disney animated version, and here we go.
Oh, boy. It's nicely done, though. I mean, in the Disney style.
Right.
But I don't know if it's... We'll just leave it at that.
And, you know, that's the thing I always wonder about. You know, if you could take... I mean, literally take the audio from the film and just completely create an animated version of it, How does that change your enjoyment of the film itself?
It doesn't.
I'm not saying it doesn't. I'm just saying, you know, approaching it from that different way, it's just, you know, because it's another visual take on it, even if the audio is the actual exactly the same. And this would be the oddball time where it would be, because being animated, obviously, that's the one aspect you wouldn't have, is you wouldn't have the audio. But if you just use this audio straight from the original film, and did an animated film to everything. No, not rotoscoping like, what's his name does, Linklater does in those movies, but, you know, an actual animated style. I was wondering how much different that would feel. Anyway.
I am against it.
Nay to the animated one. So the next.
Nay, I say.
There's his sword.
Yes. Yes.
At last.
So there, the first one here, there's two unknowns. There is this red one, which I really like. Very simple, very to the point.
Yeah, I like his famous phrase being the blade of the sword.
Exactly.
That's brilliant.
I love the red one. I like the green one, but I love the red one.
Yeah, the red one is, and we generally have a few of these for almost any title we do, Stoya, and it's always interesting to see how successful they are in their minimalism. Mm. This green one with the hand, it's a kind of a typical style where they'll take one particular iconic image and make that a silhouette on a white background, and then fill inside that image a layered sort of depiction of other things from the film. I don't know that choosing
the six-fingered man.
Well, choosing the six-fingered hand, I like in and of itself, but then putting the sword fight with him and Wesley inside of that, I don't know if that's the right choice. I think there are other ways to go with it, but that's just me. And then this last one I found by Waddle and Daub, which I think from their website, which did not give their names anywhere, are probably a husband and wife illustrator team. But this is fun. It's just this is almost from a children's book, like a children's book layout of the adventure.
I love this one. This is great. Yeah. This would make me want to see the movie if I knew nothing about it.
Yeah.
It's almost like an introduction to the idea of the Princess Bride.
But it makes like every event like just makes you interested in each step of the journey. I think it's great.
That's fun.
That's fun.
And it's well mapped out too. Almost better than the guy who did the book, the Cinemaps book.
So that's the posters.
Nice.
So then we get to what we like to call the martini, which is where we discuss where this film sits in amongst the library of this director's work. This is just so what I wrote down as notable films for Rob Reiner, and again I'm using Rotten Tomatoes as my baseline for rankings. So I'll go through his top films on Rotten Tomatoes and their rankings, which is The Princess Bride is the first at 97%. This is Spinal Tap at 95. Stand By Me, 91. The American President, 91. Misery, 90. When Harry Met Sally, 90. The Sure Thing, 85. And A Few Good Men at 83. From there, there is an appreciable drop in accepted quality of Rob Reiner's films down into somewhere in the low 50s, which all become then not fresh, according to Rotten Tomatoes. So, and I think looking over the films there, I think we would probably all agree that this is the cream of the crop as far as his film library goes. Latham, what do you think?
Stand By Me is one of my favorite films of all time, top 10. So that's what I think is his best film. Few Good Men is flawless.
And written by my favorite screenwriter.
Who is it?
Sorkin.
Yeah. You know, again, When Harry Met Sally's a pretty perfect film. Everything from A Few Good Men to when he started, I don't see any bad films there. I think they're all different genres. They all resonate emotionally. And they're all memorable. You know, you mention any of those films, people know immediately what you're talking about. Maybe Sure Thing is a little bit more obscure, but that's a great gem from the 80s.
Yeah, I'm actually, when I was looking at the list, I was actually surprised that people rank that film of his that high. That seems like a film that would rank lower in the 60s or 70s for most people, but I was certainly happy to see it. And I constantly forget that he directed Misery. The way that Spinal Tap is such a different film from most of these others, Misery is again a whole entire different animal.
Yep, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hassan, what are your feelings on it?
I think The Princess Bride is my favorite Rob Reiner film, next to Misery, which was a tremendous actual theatrical experience for me. You know, because I'm not a huge horror fan, so that kind of snuck up on me. I thought it was I knew it was a Stephen King film, but I thought it was going to be a little different than it was. I didn't think it was going to be as scary as it was. I thought it was one of his more esoteric ones, like Shawshank or something like that. And then, no, this is a straightforward horror film. But definitely The Princess Bride is my favorite Rob Reiner experience. And it's the one I've gone back to countless times.
Right.
Next to When Harry Met Sally, probably the second most watched Rob Reiner film that I've seen. So, but I would say The Princess Bride is his top. His best film? I don't know. I would have to agree that A Few Good Men is almost a flawless movie, you know? It's probably his best. from my perspective, which means nothing.
Well,
but I think that's his best film.
It means something to us.
Storia?
I think Princess Bride is the best of the ones I've seen. I haven't seen many of the others.
Okay. Well, I mean, and plus the fact that this was your favorite film, clearly that would lend one to believe that this is going to lead to back anyway.
The deck was stacked on that one.
Yes. Yeah. And I think the red poster was my favorite movie poster.
Oh, really? Okay.
Followed second by the little illustrations of every Art Deco style one.
The Matthew Peake.
Ina.
Oh, Issa Anafada.
Issa. Yeah.
Issa.
Okay, great. And so that leads us to thanks to Purple Planet Music. Get your own awesome music at purple-planet.com. Please check out our website at cinementalpod.com for all the poster images we discuss on our Down the Tube segments. And don't forget to download and subscribe to Cinemental wherever you enjoy your podcasts or you listen to your new episodes at our website or at cinemental.podbean.com. Also, you can follow us on all major social media accounts at CinementalPod. Do you have anything you want to promote, Sarah?
Yes, if you're over the age of 18, check out zerospaces.com, but it's like really, really, really only for adults. Otherwise, I have an Instagram where occasionally I post pictures of Pixel Cat.
And absolutely, definitely worth a follow there. Thanks to Hassan and Latham, as always, and our awesome guest, Stoya, who I was ecstatic to be able to get on the show, and always nice to see you.
Thanks for having me.
We'll have to grab dinner once all this nonsense is over.
Yes.
And always in the words of our very special friend and mentor, Truman Burbank.
Good afternoon, good evening, and good night.